This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Hi there, we are James and Dan, two fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words "Jesus saves" written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
Erin Patterson has just become one of the longest-serving female inmates in Victorian history after she was sentenced to life behind bars with a non-parole period of 33 years, which means with time already served, she'll be in her 80s before she's eligible for release and her children will be in their 40s. The triple murderer controlled the narrative for so long. She played the victim and dodged the truth, trying to outsmart the system. But in the end, it wasn't her words that mattered. It was the judges.
The case no longer sits in the realm of investigation. The evidence has been tested, the verdict delivered. What remains is the court's reasoning. This episode centers on the sentencing remarks of the judge, delivered after the trial is concluded and responsibility has been determined. There is no reconstruction here and no analysis, only the language of the court, setting out how the outcome was reached and what follows from it. This is the sentence.
Erin Patterson, after a long trial, during which you gave evidence that the poisoning of your four lunch guests on the 29th of July was an accident, the jury found you guilty of 3 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder. In other words, the jury necessarily found that you deliberately served poison meals to Gail and Don Patterson and Heather and Ian Wilkinson, and that you did so intending to kill them. Only Ian Wilkinson survived. The maximum penalty for murder is life imprisonment, and for attempted murder, 25 years imprisonment. Murder is also a standard sentence offence, and the standard sentence offence for murder is 25 years imprisonment. The prosecution submits, and your counsel concedes, that your offending falls into the worst category of offending for these offences, and that you should receive the maximum penalties for your crimes. I agree, for reasons that I will come to in due course. The prosecution also submits that, having regard to the horrendous nature of your crimes, I should not fix a non-parole period. In other words, the prosecution submits that you should never have the opportunity of being released from prison on parole. Your counsel challenged this submission, relying principally on the harsher-than-usual conditions of your imprisonment, which both sides agree are likely to continue for the foreseeable future. Whether or not to fix a non-parole period is the main dispute which I have to determine. These sentencing reasons consist of 4 parts. First, the circumstances of the offences. Second, your circumstances. Third, relevant sentencing law. And fourth, the actual sentences. It is convenient at this stage to mention one aspect of sentencing law. Where the prosecution alleges circumstances that aggravate your offending, the prosecution must prove those circumstances beyond reasonable doubt. Where the defence alleges circumstances of mitigation, the defence must prove those circumstances on the balance of probabilities. Just before I turn to the circumstances of your offences, I note that at your trial, the prosecution conceded that they could not prove motive. As is standard, I directed the jury that the prosecution did not have to prove motive, only the elements of the offences, and that, quote, some murders occur for no apparent reason. The motives for such murders may only ever be known to the offenders. Clearly, the jury was satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that you committed the alleged offences. Only you know why you committed them. I will not be speculating about that matter. I will begin my discussion of the circumstances of your offences with the fact that you were familiar with the iNaturalist website from at least May 2022. That is a website on which people can post and view sightings of deathcap mushrooms, amongst other things. On the 28th of May 22, you accessed the iNaturalist website and navigated to its worldwide map in relation to sightings of deathcap mushrooms. Using that map, you accessed information concerning the sighting of deathcap mushrooms in Moorabbin, a suburb of Melbourne. In late 22, a dispute arose between you and your estranged husband, Simon Patterson, regarding child support payments for your two young children who live with you. In December 22, you referred to that dispute in your communications with a Facebook Messenger group, with whom you shared an interest in true crime. You were scathing in your remarks about both Simon and his parents, Don and Gail Patterson. Amongst other things, you derided your father-in-law's suggestion that you and Simon get together and pray for your children, commenting, quote, this family, I swear to fucking God. You called them, quote, a lost cause. You wondered whether they had, quote, any capacity for self-reflection at all. You said, quote, fuck 'em, and that you suspected the best thing you could do was, quote, just to forget about all of them and live your life. You accused Simon of, quote, gaslighting you, and Don and Gail of using, quote, weasel words. You called Simon, quote, a deadbeat, and wondered why Gail was not, quote, horrified by his stance regarding child support. According to your testimony at trial, and to a lesser extent Simon's testimony, the dispute over child support had resolved by early 23. On the 18th of April 23, one Christine McKenzie, a former poison specialist, was visiting her daughter in Lock, which is a small town about a 25-minute drive northwest of Leongatha, where you lived. Miss McKenzie observed deathcap mushrooms in Lock Reserve and posted details of her observations, including photographs, on the iNaturalist's website the same day. Miss McKenzie disposed of all the deathcap mushrooms that she could find because of the dangers she thought they posed, especially to young children. On the morning of the 28th of April 23, your mobile phone, which was never recovered by investigators, connected to certain cell towers consistent with a possible visit by you to the Lock Reserve. That afternoon, you purchased a food dehydrator in Leongatha. Between the 28th of April and the 4th of May 23, you photographed foraged mushrooms on the trays of your dehydrator. The images were found by investigators on a Samsung tablet later seized from your home. Dr. Tom May, a world-renowned expert in fungi, gave evidence at your trial that those images were, quote, consistent with deathcap mushrooms to a high degree of confidence. On the 21st of May, 23, Dr. May observed deathcap mushrooms in Nielsen Street, Outram. Outram is a small town about a 23-minute drive southwest of Leongatha. Later that day, Dr. May posted details of his observations, including photographs, on the iNaturalist website. On the morning of the 22nd of May 23, your phone connected to certain cell towers, consistent with a possible visit by you to Lock Reserve. Later that morning, your phone connected to certain cell towers consistent with a possible visit by you to Nielsen Street, Outram. On the 24th of June, 23, you hosted a lunch at your Leongatha home, attended by Don and Gail and your children. You had invited Simon to that lunch, but he declined, saying in a text message, quote, "Hi, Aaron. Thank you for your kind lunch invite, together with Mum and Dad. I'm sorry, I'll decline, as I feel too uncomfortable about it." Between the 28th of June and the 7th of July, 23, there were a series of messages between you and Gail in which you falsely represented that you had undergone a needle biopsy for a lump in your arm and an MRI. In response to a message from Gail as to how you got on with your medical test, you messaged her on the 7th of July 23 that, quote, "There's a bit to digest with everything that's come out of it all. I might talk more about it with you both when I see you in person." On the 16th of July 23, you attended the Sunday service at the Corumburra Baptist Church, where Ian Wilkinson was and is the pastor. After the service, you invited Gail and Don Patterson and Heather and Ian Wilkinson to lunch at your home at Gibson Street, Leongatha, on the 29th of July 23. Both the Pattersons and the Wilkinsons were surprised by the invitation, as the Wilkinsons had never previously been invited to a meal at your home. You also invited Simon, telling him that you had invited his parents and his aunt and uncle. You told him you had some important medical news which you wanted to discuss at the lunch and that you did not want the children to be present. Simon initially accepted your invitation and informed his parents that the purpose of the lunch was to discuss your medical issues and how to inform the children. On the evening of the 28th of July, 23, Simon and you exchanged messages. Simon's read, quote, "Sorry, I feel too uncomfortable about coming to the lunch with you, Mum, Dad, Heather and Ian tomorrow, but I am happy to talk about your health and implications of that at another time if you'd like to discuss on the phone. Just let me know." You replied 5 minutes later, quote, "That's really disappointing. I've spent many hours this week preparing lunch for tomorrow, which has been exhausting in light of the issues I'm facing, and spent a small fortune on beef eye fillet to make beef Wellingtons because I wanted it to be a special meal, as I may not be able to host a lunch like this again for some time. It's important to me that you're all there tomorrow and that I can have the conversations that I need to have. I hope you'll change your mind. Your parents and Heather and Ian are coming at 12:30. I hope to see you there." On Saturday, the 29th of July, 23, you served your four lunch guests individual beef Wellingtons, which were deliberately poisoned with deathcap mushrooms. You gave evidence at your trial that had Simon attended the lunch, you would also have served him a beef Wellington. I accept the evidence of Ian Wilkinson that you served your guests their meals on four grey plates, while your individual beef Wellington was on a smaller orangey-tan coloured plate, a fact that Heather also commented on to Ian and Simon the next day. I find that you did this to ensure that you did not mistakenly consume a poisoned meal. I also accept the evidence of Ian Wilkinson that at the conclusion of the meal, you falsely told your guests that you had been diagnosed with cancer and sought their advice as to whether and how you should break the news to your children that you had a life-threatening illness. Not long after this conversation started, your son and his friend, who had gone to a movie, returned home. The conversation about cancer ceased, but not before all your lunch guests, at Ian's suggestion, prayed for your health. Soon after, they left. Around midnight to 1 a.m. on Sunday the 30th of July 23, all of your lunch guests fell seriously ill, suffering repeated vomiting and diarrhoea. On Sunday morning, Gail and Don informed Simon of their conditions and called an ambulance, which took them to nearby Corumburra Hospital. Simon attended the Wilkinsons' home to find that Heather and Ian were similarly unwell. He took them first to Corumburra Hospital, but was redirected to Leongatha Hospital because of limited resources. By way of contrast, you made a round trip of approximately 2 hours on Sunday afternoon to take your son to a flying lesson at Tyab. By the Sunday evening, Don and Gail had been transferred to Dandenong Hospital. On the morning of Monday, the 31st of July, 23, Ian and Heather were also transferred to Dandenong Hospital. Later that day, Gail and Don were transferred to the Austin Hospital, as were Heather and Ian on Tuesday, the 1st of August, 23. All of them were experiencing advanced multiple organ failure. Having learned from Simon on the Sunday that your parents-in-law had been hospitalised, you attended Leongatha Hospital on the Monday, complaining of diarrhoea. You did not stay long. Shortly after a doctor indicated to you that death cap mushroom poisoning was suspected, you left, despite warnings by another doctor and nurse that your life was in danger. You returned over an hour and a half later. When you returned, you showed reluctance to receive treatment for suspected death cap mushroom poisoning and to organise a medical assessment for your children who were at school. Medical staff were urging you to have the children assessed because you claimed, falsely, that on the Sunday night you fed them the leftovers of the beef Wellingtons with the pastry and mushrooms scraped off. Eventually, you arranged with Simon to collect the children and bring them to hospital. On the Monday morning, police recovered beef Wellington remains from a bin outside your home, which were later found to contain death cap mushroom toxins. On the Monday afternoon, you were transferred to Monash Medical Centre in Clayton. Simon brought the children there. You and the children were kept in hospital overnight for observation. At both Leongatha Hospital and Monash Medical Centre, you were asked by various people, including doctors and representatives of the Health Department and the Child Protection Service, where you had sourced the mushrooms for the beef Wellingtons. You said you had purchased some fresh mushrooms at Woolworths and some dried mushrooms from an Asian grocery. You were vague about the location of the Asian grocery, claiming you had purchased the dried mushrooms several months before and that the shop could have been in one of a number of suburbs that fall within the boundaries of the city of Monash. You denied having foraged for mushrooms, a lie repeated in your recorded police interview on the 5th of August, 23. At your trial, you maintained the story about having sourced some of the mushrooms from an Asian grocery, but testified that in May and June of 23, you had foraged for edible mushrooms in various places, including the Corumburra Botanical Gardens. You testified that you had dehydrated these mushrooms and put them in a container which contained the dried mushrooms from the Asian grocery, and that you used the dried mushrooms in that container, along with the fresh mushrooms from Woolworths, in the beef Wellingtons. You testified that in this way, death cap mushrooms must have accidentally found their way into the meals served to your lunch guests. The jury rejected this elaborate explanation. They found that you deliberately poisoned the meals of your lunch guests. I am satisfied that your vague story about the Asian grocery was a lie. When you realised that the lie would not work because death cap mushrooms cannot be cultivated commercially, and there were no other reports of people falling ill from mushrooms purchased at Asian groceries, you changed tack. You concocted the story you told the jury about foraged mushrooms ending up in the container with the Asian grocery mushrooms and then accidentally ending up in the beef Wellingtons. On the afternoon of Tuesday, the 1st of August, 23, you and the children were discharged from Monash Hospital. On the morning of the 2nd of August 23, you disposed of your dehydrator at a local tip, the Coonawarra Transfer Station. On the 4th of August 23, investigators recovered your dehydrator from the tip. Forensic examination revealed that the dehydrator contained traces of death cap mushrooms. That same day, 4th of August 23, Heather Wilkinson, aged 66, and Gail Patterson, age 70, died from death cap mushroom poisoning. and Don Patterson, who was desperately ill, was given a liver transplant. On the 5th of August, 23, the police executed a search warrant at your home. You handed over a dummy phone. It was not the phone that you had been using throughout most of 23, the phone which on the 28th of April, 23, had connected to certain cell towers indicating a possible visit to Locke, and which on the 22nd of May, 23, had connected to certain cell towers indicating possible visits to Locke and Outram. In your recorded interview following the search, you denied having foraged for mushrooms and denied owning a dehydrator. Late on the 5th of August, 23, Don Patterson, aged 70, died from death cap mushroom poisoning. Ian Wilkinson very nearly died, but gradually his condition improved. On the 21st of August, 23, he was discharged from the intensive care unit to a ward at the Austin Hospital. On the 11th of September, 23, he was moved to the Heidelberg Repatriation Hospital. On the 21st of September, 23, he was discharged home. He has not fully recovered. He has reduced kidney function, ongoing respiratory issues, and reduced energy. On the 2nd of November, 23, the police executed another search warrant at your home, seizing more electrical devices. You were arrested and charged. You have been in custody ever since. Let me now summarise the aggravating circumstances of your offending. Your offending, which resulted in the death of three people and near death of another, involved substantial premeditation. I am satisfied that by the 16th of July 23, when you unusually invited Simon, his parents and his aunt and uncle to a lunch without the children to discuss your non-existent medical issues, you did so with the intention of killing them all. The dehydrator, which you purchased in late April 23, enabled you to preserve death cap mushrooms, which you put into the individual beef wellingtons served to your guests. Whether those death cap mushrooms came from Locke on the 28th of April 23, or from Locke or Outram on the 22nd of May 23, or from another location in May or June of 23, as you suggested in your testimony, is in my view of no great moment. After learning from Simon on Sunday the 30th of July 23 that some or all of your lunch guests had been hospitalised, you showed no pity for your victims. Instead of informing those treating the Pattersons and Wilkinsons that you had used foraged mushrooms, which you could have done without having to admit that you had deliberately poisoned their meals, you repeatedly denied foraging, insisting that the mushrooms for the beef wellingtons were sourced solely from Woolworths and an Asian grocery. We will never know whether revealing the use of foraged mushrooms would have made a difference. But the administration of the drug psilocybin, which is a specific antidote for death cap mushroom poisoning, was not commenced on the 30th of July 23 because at that stage the evidence regarding the type of toxin was inconclusive. Similarly, the administration of NAC to preserve the victims' livers from toxins was not commenced until almost midnight on the 30th of July 23 for Don Patterson and on the 31st of July 23 for the others. The prosecution submitted that I should infer from your pitiless behaviour that your intention to kill was ongoing and that this constitutes an additional aggravating circumstance. I accept that submission. As the Wilkinson's daughter, Ruth Dubois, remarked in her victim impact statement, you, quote, followed through on your lethal plan. Your lunch guests each suffered severe gastrointestinal illness on the Sunday and Monday prior to being sedated and mechanically ventilated. Their suffering was protracted, and Ian Wilkins suffers ongoing health issues. This aggravates your offending. The prosecution submitted that you must have anticipated that your victims would suffer in the way they did. I am satisfied of that beyond reasonable doubt. It is implausible that you would have selected death cap mushrooms without ascertaining how they would work upon your victims. Further, the devastating impact of your crimes is not limited to your direct victims. Your crimes have harmed a great many people. I will expand on this aggravating circumstance when I turn to the victim impact statements. In addition to denying the use of foraged mushrooms, you engaged in an elaborate cover-up of your guilt. I find that you disposed of the four grey plates on which you served the poisoned beef wellingtons. You falsely made out that you had fed your children leftover beef wellingtons with the pastry and mushrooms scraped off. You feigned illness. You disposed of the dehydrator soon after you were released from hospital. You maintained the vague story about sourcing dried mushrooms at an Asian grocery and had the gall to tell police in your recorded police interview that you had been very, very helpful to the health department in its investigation of the incident. You disposed of your phone and provided police with a dummy phone. You lied to the police in your recorded police interview about various matters. Finally, and most importantly, your offending involved an enormous betrayal of trust. Your victims were all your relatives by marriage. More than that, they had all been good to you and your children over many years, as you acknowledged in your testimony. Not only did you cut short three lives and cause lasting damage to Ian Wilkinson's health, thereby devastating the extended Patterson and Wilkinson families, you inflicted untold suffering on your own children, whom you robbed of their beloved grandparents. The victim impact statements reveal the immense and ongoing anguish suffered by your many victims, direct and indirect. No summary could do justice to the individual and collective power of those statements. It is not my intention here to summarise or refer to every statement, but rather to highlight some key aspects. Four generations of the extended Patterson and Wilkinson families have been traumatised by your crimes, not to mention their friends. Don's mother, Martha Patterson, who is aged 100, made a victim impact statement. In it, she prayed for God's healing for her family. Gail and Heather's father, now deceased, also reached his 100th birthday in 2024, but tragically, only one of his three daughters, Lynn Young, whose statement was read to the court, was alive to mark that milestone with him. And there are many references in the statements to the trauma experienced by the Patterson and Wilkinson grandchildren. Many of your adult victims struggled not only with the loss of their loved ones and the terrible way they died, but with the distress, even guilt, at their own seeming inability to ease the suffering of those close to them. They keenly feel their limitations, and in particular, the impossibility of shielding the youngest from the incessant discussion of the case in the media, online, in public spaces, even in the schoolyard. Many also struggled to cope with work and studies, and many have experienced additional financial burdens. There is, of course, great anger at the callousness of your actions. To take just one example, Ian Wilkinson's sister, Dorothy Dicker, questions, quote, how anyone could sit there and watch those four kind and caring people eat that meal. Your failure to exhibit any remorse pours salt into all the victims' wounds. The children of your direct victims speak of the distress of watching their parents suffer in hospital. For example, Don and Gail's son Matthew remarks, quote, watching my parents suffer in hospital from severe poisoning caused shock, grief and lasting trauma. Ian and Heather's son, David, remembers his mother being, quote, desperate for water, which she was not allowed by medical staff, and saying her, quote, insides were burning. David also mentions his father's tortured experience, quote, black lips, gaunt face, pained and serious expression. At your plea hearing, Ian Wilkinson memorably read his victim impact statement to the court. Amongst other things, he humbly expressed his great admiration and love for his wife, Heather, and his concern for others, even you, He offered you forgiveness for what you did to him. Quote, in regards to the many harms done to me, I make an offer of forgiveness to Aaron. I say harms done to me advisedly. I have no power or responsibility to forgive harms done to others. However, I encourage Aaron to receive my offer of forgiveness for those harms done to me with full confession and repentance. I bear her no ill will. That offer of forgiveness presents you with an opportunity. You would do well to embrace it in the manner he suggests. In commenting on the unprecedented coverage of your case, Ian Wilkinson also made this point. Quote, it's one of the distressing shortcomings of our society that so much attention is showered on those who do evil and so little on those who do good. Your lunch guests undoubtedly belong to that company of people among us who do good. The victim impact statements make it clear that each one of them, over many years, gave of themselves generously and made lasting contributions to many, many lives, and in Ian's case, continues to make. All of them, inspired by their Christian faith, were deeply invested not only in their families but in their wider communities, as the statements from members of the Currumburra Baptist Church attest. A word that is used again and again in the statements to describe your crimes is, quote, senseless. But what also surfaces in the statements is hope and gratitude for the care shown by others. Don and Gail's daughter, Anna Terrington, writes, quote, we have to say goodbye for now to Mum and Dad and Heather. Don's brother Colin writes, quote, as Christians they were people of hope, and sharing that hope, my loss is not one marked by despair. Ruth Dubois expresses her great appreciation for the efforts made and compassion shown by the medical teams. Simon Patterson gives thanks, quote, for the incredibly strong, gentle, patient and caring support from friends, family, schools, our own church congregation, the wider church, colleagues, work clients, neighbours, police, government officers, and our professional counsellors. We have experienced love in a special way since the murders. I will conclude my account of key aspects of the victim impact statements with what Don and Gail's son Matthew had to say about your betrayal of trust. Quote, Erin was embraced as part of the Patterson family. She was welcome and treated with genuine love and respect in a way she did not appear to experience from her own family. Her actions represent a profound and devastating betrayal of the trust and love extended to her. Having regard to the aggravating circumstances of your offending and the victim impact statements, I have no hesitation in finding that your offending falls into the worst category for the offences of murder and attempted murder. As the case law makes clear, the fact that it is possible to imagine even worse instances of such offences does not refute that categorisation. The gravity of your offending warrants the imposition of the maximum penalties for your crimes. I turn then to your circumstances. The information I was provided about your personal history was minimal. Your counsel simply relied on the personal history you provided in your trial testimony. There were no psychiatric or psychological reports provided, no references from character witnesses. No doubt that approach to your plea hearing was based on your instructions, but it means the account of your personal history that I am about to give is limited. You were born in Adelaide on the 30th of September 1974, making you 48 years old at the time of your offending and 50 now. Your maiden name was Scudder. In 1977, your family relocated to Melbourne, residing in Hampton. In 2004, you and Simon Patterson met whilst you were both employed at Monash City Council. Simon told the jury that he was working there as a civil engineer and you were the RSPCA's representative on the council. By 2005, you and Simon were romantically involved. In 2006, your grandmother died, leaving you a substantial inheritance. Monies from her estate were distributed between 2007 and 2015. During those years, you would be generous with your money to Simon's siblings, providing large, no-interest loans to them and their spouses so that they could purchase their own homes. On the 2nd of June 2007, you and Simon married. You told the jury that your parents did not attend the wedding. They were holidaying in Russia. Soon after your marriage, you and Simon travelled around Australia and overseas for a few months before settling in Perth. Simon got a job working for an inner-city shire council. In 2009, when you were 34, your son was born. In April 2009, you and Simon set off with the baby to explore the top end of Australia. You reached Townsville in November 2009, at which point you parted company. You flew back to Perth. Simon drove back with the baby. You rented a cottage for you and the baby. Simon rented an on-site caravan close by. This was the first of many comparatively short-term separations. You reunited by the end of January 2010. In 2011, your father died. In that year, you also opened a second-hand bookshop in Pemberton, Western Australia. In 2013, when you were pregnant, you and Simon returned to Victoria with your son to live closer to Simon's family. In 2014, your daughter was born. In 2015, you and Simon separated permanently. In 2019, your mother died, leaving you an inheritance. In June 22, you and your children moved into a newly constructed home at 84 Gibson Street, Leongatha, the home at which you served the fatal lunch on the 29th of July, 23. You have no relevant criminal history. You maintain your innocence. In other words, there is no evidence of remorse. I turn now to the conditions of your imprisonment. As mentioned, you have been in custody since the 2nd of November 23. There were two affidavits tendered relating to your conditions of imprisonment. The first was sworn by a solicitor who acts for you and was based largely on your instructions. The second affidavit was sworn by Jennifer Hosking, Assistant Commissioner, Sentence Management Division at Corrections Victoria, who also testified at your plea hearing. Ms. Hosking's evidence included confirmation of the following matters. You have a, quote, maximum security rating and, quote, major offender status. Because of the nature of your crimes and your notoriety, you have been assessed as being at significant risk from other prisoners. You have not been assessed as posing a risk to other prisoners. You have spent approximately 16 months of your 22 months at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre in a management unit called the Gordon Unit, and the rest of the time in a protection unit called the Murray Unit. A management unit is more restrictive than a protection unit. You have been in the Gordon Unit continuously for the last 15 months. The Gordon Unit has about 20 cells. You are not permitted to mix with the other women in the Gordon Unit. You have spent at least 22 hours in your cell every day that you have been in the Gordon Unit. There have been 16 days since November 24 where, because of lockdowns, you have been confined to your cell for the entire 24 hours per day. The maximum period that a prisoner in the Gordon Unit could have out of their cell on any given day is 4 hours, but, quote, that wouldn't happen very often. Your meals and medicine are currently delivered through a flap in your cell door. There is a small concrete yard, approximately 2 metres by 1.5 metres, which adjoins your cell, which, with permission, you may access for fresh air. If prisoners are using the larger exercise yard, which abuts your exercise yard, you may not use your small yard. During your time in the Gordon Unit, you have barely had any contact with other individuals. Permission is required for you to communicate with any other prisoner, which, according to your counsel, is complicated by the fact that you are not informed of the identities of the other prisoners in the Gordon unit. You currently have approval to communicate with one other prisoner in the Gordon unit through a wire mesh when the two of you are permitted to use your respective adjoining exercise yards. That other prisoner is undergoing a lengthy sentence for terrorism offences and has attacked other prisoners. You did not ask to communicate with that person and have not communicated with her. The suggestion that you should communicate with her was made by a corrections officer. There is an intercom in your cell which, if permission is granted, you may use to communicate with one other prisoner in the unit at a time, but you have not done so. In order to attend any other part of the prison, for example, the visitor's centre or the library, you are driven there escorted by two corrections officers. While, theoretically, prisoners in the Gordon unit are able to access the prison library twice per week for 20 minutes at a time, you have not been able to do so because of staff shortages and a rule that you may not access the library if another is doing so. Consequently, you have only been able to access the library a handful of times during your time in the Gordon unit. United Nations guidelines, known as the Bangkok Rules, provide that a prisoner should not be in separation for more than 15 days at a time, but you have now been in separation continuously for 15 months. There are two prisoners in the Gordon unit who have been there in excess of 3 years. And whilst the primary principle in the placement of prisoners is to manage and place them in the least restrictive environment necessary to ensure the safety and security of the individual prisoner and other prisoners, the least restrictive environment can be very restrictive. As for your future conditions of imprisonment, whilst your placement in the Gordon unit is reviewed monthly, Ms. Hosking was unable to say whether you would ever be moved from the Gordon unit. I infer that given the unprecedented media coverage of your case and the books, documentaries and TV series about you, which are all in the pipeline, you are likely to remain a notorious prisoner for many years to come and as such remain at significant risk from other prisoners. I turn then to a number of relevant sentencing principles and rules. Section 5 of the Sentencing Act 1991 declares that the only purposes for which sentences may be imposed are just punishment, specific and general deterrence, rehabilitation, denunciation, and protection of the community. I have had regard to all of these sentencing purposes in formulating my sentences, but rehabilitation has taken a back seat because of the gravity of your offending. Other provisions of the Sentencing Act that are of particular relevance to your case are as follows. Under Section 6A to 6F, you fall to be sentenced as a serious violent offender in respect of the three murders, meaning that the protection of the community is the principal purpose for which the sentences on those counts must be imposed. Under Section 6F, your status as a serious violent offender must be entered in the court records. Section 11(1) provides relevantly that if a court sentences an offender to be imprisonment for the term of her natural life, the court must, as part of the sentence, fix a period during which the offender is not eligible to be released on parole, unless it considers that the nature of the offence makes the fixing of such a period inappropriate. Section 11A(4A) provides that where an offender is sentenced to life imprisonment, the sentencer must fix a non-parole period of at least 30 years, unless it is not in the interests of justice to do so. Is it inappropriate to fix a non-parole period? Would fixing a non-parole period be contrary to the interests of justice? As mentioned above, this is the main dispute that I have to determine. Sentencing case law establishes that, as a general rule, harsher than normal conditions of imprisonment will warrant mitigation of penalty. There is nothing about your conduct whilst in custody which might cast doubt on the application of that general rule. As Ms. Hosking indicated, you are in a management unit to protect you from other prisoners, not vice versa, nor do you have any relevant criminal history. In their written submissions, the prosecution conceded that your conditions of imprisonment are more burdensome than for a mainstream prisoner, and that they are likely to remain so for the foreseeable future. The prosecution submitted that this is a, quote, relevant consideration for sentence. In oral submissions, the prosecution conceded that this consideration was not just relevant, but, quote, important and, quote, weighty, while still pressing for life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. You have effectively been held in continuous solitary confinement for the last 15 months, and at the very least, there is a substantial chance that for your protection, you will continue to be held in solitary confinement for years to come. The Court of Appeal in Yat against the King referred without criticism to the observation that, quote, the adverse health effects of solitary confinement are well established. I note too that Ms. Hosking stated at the plea hearing that, quote, being separated has negative outcomes for people. We're very aware of that. The harsh prison conditions that you have experienced already and the likely prospect of solitary confinement for the foreseeable future are important and weighty considerations which should count for something in the sentencing exercise. In my view, the only scope for making them count is by the fixing of a non-parole period. In opposing the imposition of a non-parole period, the prosecution relied on the Queen against Colston, where the offender was sentenced to life imprisonment without a non-parole period for the savage murders of three people. But that case makes clear that, quote, where there is a substantial factor pointing towards clemency, as I consider your present and likely future conditions of imprisonment to be, the fixing of a non-parole period may be appropriate even for an offender who has committed multiple murders. Fixing a non-parole period is not to undervalue the horrendous nature of your offending. Your total effective sentence will be life imprisonment, and the period during which you will be ineligible for parole will be a very substantial one. Please stand. For the attempted murder of Ian Wilkinson, I sentence you to 25 years imprisonment. For the murder of Heather Wilkinson, I sentence you to life imprisonment. For the murder of Gail Patterson, I sentence you to life imprisonment. For the murder of Don Patterson, I sentence you to life imprisonment. All sentences are to be served concurrently. The total effective sentence is life imprisonment, and I fix a non-parole period of 33 years. I declare that you have served 676 days by way of pre-sentence detention. Finally, and by consent, I make the disposal order sought by the prosecution.
We heard the sentence from Justice Beale there. For the murder of Don Patterson, life. For the murder of Gail Patterson, life. For the murder of Heather Wilkinson, life. For the attempted murder of Ian Wilkinson, 25 years. And a non-parole period of 33 years.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our 4 favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's mind.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words "Jesus saves" written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.